This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and all across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Today we're interviewing Shane Doyle. Dr. Shane Doyle is a Montana-based scholar, teacher, and community advocate whose work focuses on the history and heritage of Native American tribes of the Northern Great Plains. Shane is an enrolled member of the Absaloqui Nation, also known as the Crow Tribe, and he holds a doctorate in curriculum and instruction from Montana State University. Shane grew up in Crow Agency, and he's built his career around making American Native American history a cultural mainstay in everything from Montana's educational system to government land management decisions. Whether designing educational curriculums, making films, or singing Northern Plains tribal music, Shane is always focused on serving his community. So welcome, Shane. It's great to be talking with you today.
Wow, thank you so much for that wonderful introduction. It's great to be here with you, John.
Okay, well, how about environmental laws? Do the U.S. environmental laws apply on reservations?
Tribes have unique status when it comes to U.S. environmental laws. You know, we have an opportunity to request different EPA standards for things like water and air. And typically, tribes have requested higher standards because they are threatened by industries just off their reservation borders, and they feel like in order to impose their sovereignty or their will to a clean environment, that, you know, they have to make sure that everyone around them is behaving in a way that's not going to contaminate their air and water as well. And so we have seen that in Montana, such as the Colstrip power plant, you know, the Northern Cheyenne, a nonprofit group from Northern Cheyenne working with the tribe filed suit that required that that coal burning power plant there to build super large air cleaners, for example. And we know of the Flathead Lake, the Salish and Kootenai, they increased the water quality on their side of the lake, and that meant that folks who were living north of the lake also had to increase their water quality as well, because the tribe, you know, got approval for a higher water quality standard.
How about the Endangered Species Act? What's the authority of that act on tribal lands?
Oh, yeah, the Endangered Species Act falls on tribal lands. You know, most tribal lands that are not private are federal, are basically overseen by the federal government. Even if they are tribal wilderness areas, you know, the federal government has the ultimate oversight over those lands, and so they all fall under federal jurisdiction.
In South Dakota, the Lakota claimed treaty rights to the Black Hills. And there was a court settlement that awarded them monetary damages, which they've rejected. And so they are holding out for the reclaiming the land itself. Now, with the Trump administration, that's obviously not going to happen. I've wondered, because there are already communities that exist on that in that area, how would they expect to reclaim the land when it's already occupied so much?
Right. Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think, you know, I can't speak for that community, for the Lakota people. You know, I'm a outsider looking in, but I think that at some point, you know, the community is going to have to come to terms with that issue. And, you know, I don't know what generation it's going to come down to, but eventually, there has to be a discussion where we say, you know, we've held out long enough and it's time to take the money now because, you know, it's going to help us in the long run to provide a better quality of life for our children. And, you know, I think that's probably something that Sitting Bull himself would have been an advocate for. But like I said, I don't want to, you know, say when that time is right or who are the right people to do that. And then the other issue there is that it's not just one reservation or one tribe. There are many reservations, many tribes, bands of Lakota that were involved with that treaty. So just because, you know, a couple of them want to settle and take the money, and that doesn't mean that they're able to, because the other ones have to agree on it as well. So it's a long and complex history, and I think it's going to be a while before we see an end to that one.
Here in the Northwest, tribes claim fishing rights that supersede the rights of others. Do you know why that issue has been so hard to settle, as in here in Washington, where I am?
Yeah, the biggest thing that the tribes in Washington have going for them is the Bolt decision, which was a federal decision. It was Judge Bolt made it, and I can't remember all the different circumstances or the precedent established, but one thing that did come out of it was that tribes have the right to fish in their historic, you know, areas. And so we know that the tribes in Washington and Oregon and California were all heavily reliant on salmon, you know, the migration of salmon up into the mountains and down back in Washington. And, you know, we just don't see that on the eastern side of the Rockies here in Montana. You know, on the eastern side, of course, was bison. And we don't see a lot of fish eaters over here on this side. Of course, the Salish and Kootenai on the west side, over on Flathead Lake, you know, they should have, you know, historic rights to fish as well, but I don't think that we have the same kind of, I think that that jurisdiction was in the Northwest Corridor, and I'm not sure if it falls for Montana.
What rights do tribes have in national monuments like Bear's Ears or Kaiparowitz?
Well, those arrangements there, like the Bear's Ears, are unique. You know, they were established beforehand. There were tribes that worked together to advocate for that and made an agreement that should it become established, that they would work together with federal agencies to create a collaborative plan to manage and protect the zone. And I think, you know, every area is different. I think that it's unique because you don't typically see that with national monuments or and you know, the unique way that the Bear's Ears was established because of its cultural significance, really primarily because of that. And so I think that, I don't know if the chances of us seeing more of those types of monuments being established in the next 4 years is very strong, but, you know, I suppose it might be a possibility.
Well, in his first administration, Trump narrowed the borders of Bear's Ears, and I'm wondering if those are gonna revert to the borders that he originally established that Biden had restored. But
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah,
I wouldn't be surprised if he says he's promised to drill baby drill. And, you know, I think there has been some oil and gas exploration in the Bear's Ears that folks would like to tap into. So, you know, that's not out of the question.
Drill, baby, drill may be countermanded by Elon Musk, who wants to sell more electric cars.
Well, let's hope so.
That's going to be an interesting development, isn't it?
Hey, if I was Elon, I wouldn't cross that guy, man. You'll find yourself someplace else.
All right. So tribal history in Yellowstone, tell me about that. It goes back a long way to Shoshone sheep eater Indians.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back so far that we really don't know who those people were, honestly.
Yeah.
Until we have some kind of a DNA test, we don't really know. But, you know, we do have the Anzac child, of course, and he's a 12,600-year-old remains. And you know,
yeah, but he wasn't
DNA
in Yellowstone. He was in Wilson,
well,
to the north.
Yeah, I mean, he was a short walk from Yellowstone. He was along the Yellowstone River.
Yeah.
I would say that when he was alive, though, that most of Yellowstone was still under ice. And I don't think we have any obsidian from that time. I think the obsidian doesn't really start to get tapped into until, you know, at least about another 1,000, 1,500 years later, maybe.
Uh-huh. That would still put it around 10,000 years ago.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yep. Right in that vicinity. You know, we know that people have been up there, and of course it just makes sense because everyone and every animal follows the river. And that was the other thing about Obsidian Cliff, is it was right along one of the tributaries to the Yellowstone River, so that made it, you know, just real easy to find and easy to navigate to and from.
Well, 100 years ago, there were Indians at least who were visiting Yellowstone, and was his name Aubrey Haynes, who did the photoshops. He collected a lot of Indian artifacts from Indians who came into his store. Today I don't know if any of the tribes claim special rights in Yellowstone. What's the situation? Do you know?
Well, I think, you know, by and large, really the only two groups that have claimed and asked for continued special privileges in the Yellowstone Park are the Shoshone Bannock at Fort Hall and the Nez Perce in Idaho.
Mm.
Both those tribes have a connection to Yellowstone Park that's very, very old, and connects to their way of life because they traveled through that area seasonally to harvest bison and then returned back into Idaho to winter there. And so, you know, the Shoshone Bannock, of course, a lot of the descendants of the Shoshone sheep-eater group now live at Fort Hall. And so they have, an ancient connection there of the really the only people who we suspect stayed in the park kind of year-round, wherever they could. And then, of course, the Nez Perce, who do a annual
pilgrimage across the park, yeah.
Yes, yeah. That's right, to commemorate the 1877 war.
Uh-huh. What unique rights do tribal members have to hunt on federal lands? You mentioned harvesting bison, which they've done at Beatty Gulch annually, and last year it was over 1,000 animals that they apparently killed. Are those tribal hunts a necessity, or are they? What's that situation that they? I don't think I could go in and shoot a bison, but tribal members apparently can do that at Bay Gulch, just north of Yellowstone.
Yeah, there's a lot of factors there. I'm glad you brought that up. You know, it doesn't look good, that's for sure. You know, all the blood, all the guts.
Right.
It looks like a giant slaughter, and it doesn't look like a real hunt. And so those are the optics of it. Of course, you know, it's the state of Montana that has said any bison that crosses that line is going to have to get killed or pushed back into the park. So, you know, it could be the Indians who shoot it, or it could be some white guys who shoot it. You know, take your pick. And I think for the Native people, you know, exercising our treaty rights, you know, our treaties are not that old. You know, our great-great-grandparents were around when those treaties were signed, and so... I think that they're still relevant. We're talking about treaties that guaranteed our right to still hunt and gather in our traditional areas off reservation. You know, the Herrera decision that was issued by a pretty conservative Supreme Court just a few years ago, I think, shocked and stunned Native people and non-Indians as well across the country. But in that instance, the Supreme Court said, yes, you know, tribes do have the right and authority to hunt in unoccupied federal lands. And so now the question is, what do you consider unoccupied? What is legally considered unoccupied? But when it comes to hunting bison outside the Yellowstone Park, we're talking about occupied lands, of course.
Uh-huh.
But we're talking about an area that bison are not allowed to enter into, and that Native people have a long-term ancient history of harvesting bison in that valley. And so even though it's not ideal circumstances, even though things need to improve and we need to find better ways to do it, Native people that right, and I think it's their right to exercise it.
Can tribal members hunt species that are on the endangered species list?
No.
Are they exempt from the ESL?
No. No, they're not.
Okay.
No.
So the issue of co-management has arisen, and I know of one mm-hmm. person at least who has voiced objections to that. What's the authority that tribes have to do co-management, how much, when they co-manage an area, a national park or a monument or a refuge or on BLM mm-hmm. lands, is there co-management authority limited, or because of treaty rights, do they have extended authority? In other words, I guess, could they hunt when they have a co-management agreement? Could they hunt on that? In that park or refuge or whatever?
Well, it's a great question. I don't think that, Native people have any kind of authority. I would say when it comes to co-management, that ultimately the federal government has this final say over everything.
Uh-huh.
And when it comes to co-management, I would say what we're talking about is a collaboration of decisions, a collaborative process to make decisions within national parks and other public lands that is more democratic, more inclusive. It has an open ear to the ancient history and ecosystem of that place. And I think that, that's what it's meant to do, is to bring some traditional ecological knowledge to the table when we're talking about co-managing places like, I'm thinking of the Bears Ears, but honestly, I can't think of too many other places that are co-managed. What we're talking about is, tribal representatives, tribal members who have deep knowledge of that ecology, who can enter into conversations with agency officials who are managing and overseeing wildlife and plants and visitors and a myriad of other different things, and helping to guide a more natural approach to overseeing the land. And I think that we don't know what that looks like in every instance, but what it means is, to me, is, again, a democratic process that Native people have been excluded from for too long and are now being invited to enter into. That doesn't mean that everyone or all of them are going to even want to or even have the capacity to do that. But I think it is a hopeful sign that not necessarily Native people can come back and start hunting on public lands or you know, other areas, but we can start going back to have ceremonies in those lands, that we can bring our young people there to tell the stories that have been told since time immemorial about why those places are important to us and why the animals and the water and the plants and you know, the sun and the moon and the stars are all important to us. And to me, that's what co-management is about. That's why it's important.
Well, one of the other concerns is that could co-management mean that a tribe could authorize drilling on a in an area that otherwise would be where it would be prohibited? Could they assert their, coming back to the term, sovereignty and say, hey, we're co-managing, so we can issue some oil leases and allow some drilling to take place?
I suppose that might be something that they might be advocates for, but again, the federal government would have to have the final say on it. And I can't imagine that tribes would seek that kind of authority.
Well, there have been instances.
We're advocating for.
There have been instances where tribes have, I think, in some Alaska reservations, where the money has induced them to go forward with drilling projects and mining projects.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say if it's on their own tribal lands and they have the authority to go ahead and do that, you know, but I would say if it's on federal lands, then they're going to have to get permission from whoever oversees that land.
Well, it would be a
I would think it would be silly, honestly, John, to think that any Indians could come onto federal land and do what they think and want. I mean, does anyone really believe that? I can tell you it's never happened, and I don't see the day when it ever will.
I see.
We are always, always at the mercy of the federal government, and anyone who thinks otherwise is living in a fantasy land.
Do tribes embrace environmental values?
We try to. Those of us who are traditional.
Yeah.
Who believe that, you know, respecting the earth and respecting the water and the animals, you know, that's the best way. I mean, there's a lot of us that still believe that and practice that in Indian country.
Well, there's some concern that when those environmental values conflict with economic opportunities, that some tribes at least will go for the economic opportunity and overlook the environmental value. So,
well, I think that that's a great concern because tribes live in poverty for the most part.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, look around the world. I mean, how many different communities would rather live in poverty than, you know, tap the kind of natural resources that they have underneath their feet to, you know, improve their quality of life?
Mm-hmm.
And why would anyone be, you know, made to feel ashamed of that? I mean, we live in a modern world. I don't understand why natives should be held to some kind of a higher standard. Do we have to make a vow of poverty to be a real Indian?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that you know, that's realistic.
Well, the native population suffered badly in the wake of the arrival of Europeans because of disease and assault. So, what would you say? Or how do tribes feel they are owed by the white culture that dominated them? What's still outstanding that native tribal people want to see rectified?
That's a great question. I think you know, we're still learning. I think native people are still uncovering and you know, discovering their history and what we had, what we've lost, what we need and what we want for our future. I think at the very least, tribal communities today would like to see our treaty rights upheld.
Mm-hmm.
That comes to, you know, tribal sovereignty in terms of giving tribes an opportunity to create their own agency. To create healthy communities. And a lot of us do have those opportunities, and we are seizing them. But a lot of our communities have been in disarray for so long that we need a little bit more support and guidance to make our way. I think I don't think that there's necessarily a conversation in Indian country about what white people owe us. I think typically, again, it comes back to treaties. We would like to see treaties upheld. I think a lot of us are just interested in building our nations and, you know, getting support from the government to help us, or from anyone for that matter, to help us do that. And I think we do see projects, and the nonprofit world has kind of taken a foothold in Indian country. I think we see it all around throughout Montana, you know, different projects, everything from education to food systems, mm-hmm. to, you know, cultural history. You know, I have a nonprofit that does work in Yellowstone Park, and we're trying to, you know, reconnect Native people to that ancient homeland and and hopefully provide some career opportunities for young Native people to pursue, and some inspiration for a brighter future.
Well, I think that Yellowstone Park has been receptive to Native American presence. They've had weeks or that have been set aside to honor Native people, and they've put up teepees and other had other kinds of presence in the park to kind of celebrate the Indian history. Is that, are you aware of that?
Oh, yeah, I've been working with them for several years now. I've been involved with all that work.
Ah, great.
And so now we're kind of taking over our own thing, though. You know, we have a 501c3 called Yellowstone Peoples, and it's dedicated to just that specific mission.
Oh, no kidding.
So we're going to be doing it every year, a teepee village. It's going to include all the tribes that are associated with the park. It's going to be educational. It's going to be healing. It's going to be collaborative. And, you know, I'm excited for this opportunity. And, again, it wouldn't be happening without the Yellowstone Park inviting us in, Cam Shawley, Christina White, all of his staff, Bob Furman. You know, I could go on and on. Everyone there at Yellowstone Park, you know, has been really – really good to work with, and it's been a great life experience for me, and I'm excited to keep moving forward with it.
Oh, that's exciting. Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, Shane, I think we've run our course, so it has been a great conversation. I really enjoyed talking with you.
It's
been a long time, and it's good to be connecting again. So thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Our guest today has been Dr. Shane Doyle, a Bozeman, Montana-based scholar, teacher, and community advocate. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to jswilderness.com or to kgvm.org and see additional features of our website and listen to additional broadcasts. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Shell.